Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? Hello and welcome to a special edition of the podcast Reading Our Times, which is being recorded live at the Chalk History Festival near Salisbury. And that's to prove we have a very live audience here indeed today. The Chalk Festival is a fascinating and absorbing event in which anyone with any interest in history, and in my humble opinion that should be everyone, will find something to interest and entertain them. In particular, for fans of Reading Our Times, there are lots of good opportunities to speak with great authors who've written fascinating books about important ideas. And today is no exception. About 30 years ago, the American political philosopher Samuel Huntington wrote a hugely important and influential book entitled The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. In it, he predicted that the ideological wars of the 20th century, capitalist West versus communist East, were over, but that the future would be replaced not with the end of history, as his pupil Francis Fukuyama famously predicted, but rather with conflicts along cultural and religious civilizational lines. Some of his predictions were very prescient for the time. Huntington insisted that China's adoption of capitalism would not result in its adoption of liberal democracy. He spoke of a risk of a global migration crisis, and he predicted persistent ongoing tensions, perhaps even conflict, between Russia and Ukraine. But for all that, the book drew much criticism for the way in which it talked about civilizations as if they were hard-edged, clearly defined, and obviously identifiable things. Because they're not. It's something we in the West are perhaps unfamiliar with, so used to talking about the West, are we? But the general idea of civilizations is a relatively recent legacy, and if we peer into the mists of time, we can make out the very many streams and tributaries that have poured into the West over the centuries to make it what it is. Few people are better qualified to talk about this than Professor Joe Quinn. Joe is the Martin Fridrikson Fellow and Tutor in Ancient History at the University of Oxford, and the author and editor of a number of books on the ancient world, including In Search of the Phoenicians and the Hellenistic West. Her latest book speaks directly to the question of civilizations and their identity and is called How the World Made the West, a 4,000-year History. Joe, welcome to the Chalk History Festival and to Reading Our Times.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Let's start with the origins of thinking about civilization and civilizations. You write in the introduction that well into the 18th century, the biblical tradition, which drew on universalist stories of Adam and Noah, quote, encouraged an inclusive approach to the past with the idea that all humans shared a common origin and they were all members of the same family. But you write that that idea began to change from the later 18th century when different ideas of civilization and civilizations emerged. Tell us first about the emergence of civilization in the singular.
Yeah, so civilization in the singular didn't in itself pose a real problem to those ideas of universal humanity. The idea of civilization came out of Enlightenment narratives of sort of universal human progress and so on. And the idea was that, you know, if we think that humans kind of got to where we are now, or where they were then in Paris and Edinburgh, in the Glasgow in the 18th century, you know, by working their way from being first of all hunters and then becoming kind of herders and then farmers and then shopkeepers and traders and all this kind of thing, civilization kind of emerged as a sort of higher stage of human progress. And it was a universalist idea, although it has to be said that all the people who write about it, catches on very fast in the mid 18th century, this idea of civilization as what we're all really aiming for. But all the people who write about it do share the opinion that Europeans are best at it. But that's treated as a kind of coincidence at the time. So initially, it's still compatible with the idea of everyone basically being part of the same ultimate sort of social community. And it also, I mean, that's the sort of good side of it. The more negative side of it, of course, is that it was one of the justifications for European imperialism in the later 18th century. The idea that Europeans could help other people on this path to civilization that they had been peculiarly good at, usually by stealing all their stuff. But
we were civilized and they weren't.
Exactly, exactly. But they could be, was the idea, potentially. And then what happens is that in the 19th century, you begin to get people talking about multiple civilizations. Firstly, people start getting interested in how some people just really are more civilized than other people. And then this kind of breaks down into an idea of multiple civilizations. First in the past, interestingly, kind of then in the present. And that's actually a very different idea. This ends up in a very different place because these separate civilizations in the plural, the idea is that they really have their own characters. And their own limits as well. So you can't anymore necessarily say that everyone's going to get to the level of Enlightenment European intellectuals. But equally, you can rank civilizations. You can actually produce a kind of ranking of human societies on cultural grounds. And this is at the same time, of course, as people are first talking about the idea of races. And the two concepts develop very much kind of in parallel with each other, and both of them with this idea of ranking following very quickly behind the initial concept.
So I was going to probe that. There's a really important shift, isn't there, from thinking of civilizations as cultural entities. And culture is fluid, it's malleable, and then shifting towards the end of the 9th century when civilizations are racial and race is innate, right?
Right. So it starts off with these two separate ideas, both of them essentially inventions of the 18th century. On the one hand, the idea of civilization. On the other hand, the idea of race, the idea that you can classify humans biologically. So civilization is classifying humans culturally, and race would be classifying them in various ways biologically. And those two ideas kind of run along in parallel, and eventually, to most intents and purposes, converge by the end of the 19th century. And it's very striking, and to come back to the kind of imperialism sort of theme of the story, it's very striking that that's when European imperialism becomes much more brutal. I'm sure you'll know there's this kind of last gasp, last couple of generations of European empire overseas, which is, you know, even more perhaps violent and brutal than it had been in the past. And that's really comes along with this sort of racialized civilization idea.
So whether civilizations are conceived culturally or racially, or as it comes to be the case, both, your key point is that we are still today living with the idea of discrete civilizations. And whilst they might not be as conflictual as Samuel Huntington argued they were, that idea of civilizations being to these discrete, self-contained entities is profoundly misleading, right?
Absolutely. That is just not how humans work. I mean, as a historian, history happens when people meet unfamiliar ideas essentially. That's when things change. That's when something goes on. If people just talk to each other the whole time, you know, development can't really happen that way. Development and change can't happen. So really, what I'm talking about in this book is the way that meetings between people, and those, you know, not necessarily a kind of good-tempered meetings. I mean, war is just as important as sex in the story. But you know, sex, war, trade, whatever, pilgrimage is a big one. Times when people come together with people they don't spend time with usually. And that's when new ideas spark, a new technology is found or adapted or adopted, whatever it might be. That's the moment where you know, something happens. So, yeah, basically the argument in the book is that the history of human society is the history of cultural appropriation.
Now, so many histories of the West. Chapter one, it's Greece. Chapter two is Rome. Yeah. We're definitely going to talk about Greece and Rome. But often in those histories of the West, there's a kind of an introduction which talks about the Minoan civilization in Crete and the Mycenaean civilization in Peloponnese in southern Greece. And you talk about both of those. Tell us a little bit about when they were and what influence they have on this story.
Right. So the Minoans and Mycenaeans, by which we mean the people living in what's now Greece and the people living on the island of Crete, were their sort of historical moment is the Bronze Age. So we're basically talking the second millennium BCE. And they're important in the story in a couple of different ways. One of them, in the kind of sort of first level, is that they're tremendously important as connectors. These Cretans, these, let's call them Grecians, of Aegean people, because they're not just on the mainland, they're in the islands too, and so on. It's a world which is already very connected because of the short distance between the islands. So even before sailing is invented, it's relatively easy to travel around the Aegean. So it makes it a very convenient place for these kinds of productive meetings and conversations to happen. And indeed it is. It's where, sailors from Lebanon first bring cargoes from Egypt to Crete, and then they reach Greece, and then from there they reach Italy, and so on. They also connect, particularly the Greek people, the sort of Mycenaeans, as they're often known, after the site of Mycenae, to be one of the best ancient sites in the world. They have particular connections to the north, and so they're connecting to the Baltic Sea, even to Britain in the Bronze Age. It's not something we hear much about, because people tend to be interested in history sort of moving from east to west. So, right, you know, you might get Greece and Rome in the first chapters, you might get the Minoans and Mycenaeans before that, you might even get Egypt or Mesopotamia, perhaps. But it's got to be that history moves west as you carry on. But one of the things I really wanted to sort of point out in the book, that actually history is already happening in the West, in the far West, in, you know, as far as here, in the Bronze Age, and that places like this are actually connected back to those kind of famous civilizations of the Mycenaeans and Minoans. But then the other reason that they're really important in my book is that they're my first big example of how civilizations are basically made up by modern scholars. Because the Mycenaeans and the Minoans are basically the same people. Right? These are all people living in the Aegean, you know, working through the islands and so on, doing trade. Very, very similar. The fact that some of them are on the mainland and the sort of northern islands, some of them are on Crete and the sort of southern islands of the Aegean. It's really not a very big deal, and it doesn't make a very big difference in antiquity of huge amounts of connections and contact relationships and so on between Crete and the mainland, as well as sort of within both those places. And the only reason that people now think of them as Minoan civilization and Mycenaean civilization is because of a kind of competition between two archaeologists, both men, perhaps unsurprisingly, in the late 19th century, where the guy who discovered the most famous sites on the mainland decided that he would call this new Aegean civilization Mycenaean, because that was the site that he found. And the guy who found the site of Knossos on Crete, the amazing site of Knossos, decided that he would call this new Aegean civilization as a whole, this new Aegean kind of society, Minoan, because that was after his, King Minos of Crete. And so, and basically, the mainland guy thought that these Cretans were just a kind of, you know, precursor, unimportant, primitive version of his Mycenaean civilization. Whereas the Crete guy thinks that this mainland people are a sort of degenerate, decadent, late stage of his brilliant Cretan civilization. And it's only after they're both dead that people kind of solve the problem by saying, okay, we'll just call them separate things, like two different civilizations at the same time. And this is in the 1940s. I mean, before that, basically, Minoan and Mycenaean civilization weren't separate things. So yeah, that's one of the most recent inventions.
So the people that you're studying are kind of almost bound to be more primitive than the people that I'm studying.
Exactly. Either more primitive or more decadent, one or the other. The people I'm studying are clearly in their prime.
Now, you write in the book about the invention of Greece, and you make the point that the Greeks saw themselves and they wrote themselves into foreign tradition. Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of what you mean by that, and also how the Greeks understood themselves.
Oh, well, I mean, this was wonderful. This was really one of the big kind of motivating things for me in writing this book, was that I got so frustrated with the idea of sort of Greece and Rome being this kind of pristine sort of founder kind of societies, civilizations, and people don't go before them, because the Greek and Roman authors themselves don't say that at all. And the Greeks in particular are fascinated by the societies around them and constantly pointing out that they did things like philosophy and science and astronomy and all sorts of things before they, the Greeks, did them, and constantly looking for connections with them. So it's very common for Greeks to just talk about how they're related, that how their city is related to some completely different city that has no, in fact, factual relation to them at all, but is an interesting foreign city. Or even people who don't exist. I mean, the Amazons, there's a wonderful myth about Athenian kings marrying Amazon queens and so on. I mean, the Amazons are so foreign, they didn't even exist. And so there's a really... I mean, I think this is actually, as I was writing the book, I came to realise this is really true of a lot of ancient civilizations, not just the Greeks and Romans. But it's particularly true, I think, and particularly obviously true of the Greeks, that they are not only aware that they're not the first people to travel the paths that they're going down, but they're really interested in that. In fact, one of my favourite examples of that is from the Mycenaeans, the people actually from Mycenae itself, Bronze Age, back in the Bronze Age, Greek Bronze Age, where you have amber from the Baltic in some of the richest tombs. And in the same tombs, you'll have carnelian from India. And so it's not just that these things are kind of exotic and far away and beautiful and so on, but it's actually drawing attention to how vast the connections that these guys buried in these tombs have.
I want to inquire about one particular idea that we associate with Greece. They're generation upon generation of school children and political scientists after them told democracy, Greece, democracy. To what extent is that an idea that's original to that Greek culture at the time, or to what extent is it inherited, like so much else that's going on in your story?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So I think I'm going to say a third thing, that it's unoriginal, but we don't know if it's inherited or not. So the basic idea of Greek democracy, the Greek city-states, is lottery. It's nothing like democracy now. And it's not just that these are much smaller communities and there's much more of a sense of direct democracy. So sometimes you do get assemblies, quite often in Athens, for instance, where all the males, only the men, of course, but all the male citizens and only the citizens, but still all the male citizens will get together and express their opinion on a particular matter of general interest. But that's the sort of, you know, at best every week or two, you know, in many places, maybe every year or 10 years or something. What's actually happening on a day-to-day basis, the way that politics is working, is through a huge number of officials who are not elected. The only people who the Athenians actually elect are their military generals, which seems like a really bad idea. And in fact, the military history of Athens does suggest also that it was a really bad idea. But these people, in you know, 95% of cases, are selected by lottery, really complicated lottery systems. And so any of you might be an MP in, what is it, July the...
Fourth.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be terrifying, right? If you knew the election was coming up and not only are we going to have to put up with the MPs we get, but actually any of us could suddenly wake up an MP on the morning of the election, or a councillor, which is probably more the level, really. All sorts of things, all sorts of local officials and so on. And this principle of lottery, it's not just sort of elections that it works for. It also works for choosing the plays that win the dramatic competitions. So sometimes you hear, oh, this or that wonderful ancient Greek tragedy. It must have been hugely popular at the time because we know it won the dramatic competition that year in Athens. But actually winning the system by which people vote, a very few people, again, selected by lot, vote, and then the votes are selected by lot to actually count and so on. It makes a kind of mockery of it. So it's a very strange approach to introducing sort of fate into almost every level of society. So that basically is what Greek democracy is. It's really not something that would be very familiar now. But it kind of was familiar in the ancient world because the Assyrians did it first. So I think now when people think about Assyria, they think about, you know, King Ashurbanipal and all these enormous kind of great empire, rulers of huge empires and who had, you know, do terrible things to their enemies, often personally, and you know, put up the great big reliefs to celebrate what massively important and powerful guys they are. And that is true. That is exactly what Assyrian kings were like in the Iron Age in the first millennium BCE. 1,000 years earlier, though, going right back to sort of the Middle Bronze Age, right back to the beginning of the second millennium BCE, so 4,000 years ago now, so basically kind of near the beginning of my story, these Assyrians were actually kind of a rather sort of socially flat trader society. So they did have a king, but he was mostly a kind of religious figure. He doesn't seem to have had much to do with actually governing. And instead, the capital city of Ashur and all its various sort of trading posts around what's now Western Asia, would be made up of communities, of small communities where all the men, again, had some kind of involvement in politics, but again, based on the lot. And one of the wonderful things about this is that these Assyrians in the 19th, 18th century BCE are doing exactly what the Athenians do sort of 1,500 years later, which is that they name the year after their chief officials who were selected by lot, just like in Athens later. But what this means, we have these records, we know these names of these people. And so what it means is that we have, you know, hundreds of names of Assyrian politicians long before we know the name of any single Greek-speaking person. I mean, hundreds of years before we get the first names on Greece or Crete. So there's this really fascinating kind of Assyrian version of something that looks awfully like Greek democracy. I mean, what's sort of kind of both awful and wonderful and kind of interesting about this is that there's no clear proof of a connection between the two. And one of the reasons is that we actually have far more records from the Bronze Age, which is the kind of Assyrian period I'm talking about, than we do from the Iron Age, which is the sort of Greek period. And the reason for that is that people started writing on paper. which is a really bad idea in a rainy place if you want records preserved. So if people had only carried on writing on clay tablets, we would know a lot more about relations between Greece and Assyria in the kind of crucial period that any sort of transmission would be occurring. But we don't actually have, that's a sort of missing link in the chain. So I can't claim that it definitely, that the Greek version is definitely inspired by the Assyrian version, but I can say that they look awfully similar.
Yeah, similarities there. Well, like I said, you can't talk about Greece without talking about Rome. And Rome particularly fascinates me with regards to this question, because on the one hand, you know, at its apex, the empire is dominant. Rome is a huge city. Augustus, you mentioned, referred to as Princeps, first man, or the consecrated one. So there's a fairly healthy sense of their own significance and importance there. But on the other hand, you point out that Rome's foundation myth, the Aeneid, places its origins in Troy. Mm-hmm. And Roman identity was based on citizenship rather than ethnicity, and that Rome had an unusually inclusive civic ideology. Mm. So there seems to be a tension there between, you know, we are Rome, and yet at the same time, we are cognizant of our connection to the rest of the world.
Well, I mean, it's really familiar, isn't it? I mean, Britain is famously one of the most sort of successfully multicultural nations, certainly in Europe, maybe beyond. But at the same time, there's enormous tensions around that. And so I think that's something that you do see in a lot of historical societies as well, where the more kind of formally open a place is, but open might not be quite the right word, but what's really going on in Rome is that it's an immensely political society, that really being a Roman citizen is, it's a related to the taxes you pay or don't pay. It's related to your rights as a voter. It's really got very little to do with your origins or ancestry or anything like that. There isn't the idea that just because, you know, you're born somewhere, you necessarily become a citizen of that place. So Roman citizenship is something that is quite often given to other people as a reward or a bribe or all sorts of things, a present. But it's also something that's guarded at times quite jealously. So I actually think there is a tension there, but I think it's almost a kind of inherent tension in human history. And maybe it's worth that tension to have the kind of connectivity that a place like Rome does.
If we were to have a Roman philosopher join us on stage and you were to ask them, to what extent is your civilization indebted to other civilization, in inverted commas, would they have said a great deal, or would they have said, no, we're Roman?
No, I think they would probably... It's a little less clear with Roman authors than with Greek authors. There's a kind of greater variety of opinion. But no, I think they... I don't think there's any way around the fact that they would have to say, no, we are to be Roman is to be Trojan. To be Roman is also to be Italian, because the Romans, by their own myth, again, come from this marriage between a Trojan prince and an Italian princess. And what makes that complicated is that this myth kind of emerges when the Romans are taking over Italy. So it's a way of sort of this one, what had been for a long time a relatively small city-state, as it becomes the most important one in Italy, at the same time people are doubling down on the idea that Rome is Italian. Not that Italy is Roman, but that Rome is Italian. So again, it's a sort of interesting way of kind of weaving the new subject people into your own story in quite a privileged way.
And I guess it's a matter of legitimising as well. I'm really struck by, in the Middle Ages in this country, particularly, say, in the late 15th century, there's a concerted effort to identify English culture with some kind of Roman inheritance. Charlemagne does it in the 8th, 9th century. There are rumours and legends of Joseph of Arimathea coming here. It's all about if you can associate your culture with an eminent culture that came beforehand, you become more legitimate, don't you?
Right. And you see this, I mean, wonderfully, you see it in Ireland in the sort of 17th, 18th century, that as the British are kind of doubling down on the idea that they're Romans, not all of them, of course, it's very complicated, but basically that's the kind of classic idea. The Irish are like, no, we're more like the Carthaginians, you know, destroyed by this kind of wonderful, you know, artistic, fascinating maritime people destroyed by these brutal barbarians, the Romans over there, pointing in this direction. I think that desire to align yourself with past societies and the values of past societies, I think, is a really powerful one. And that's why it's important that we get the story straight, that we know what we're aligning ourselves with.
Now, the book takes right up into the Middle Ages, but there are a couple of small details from that time. Unfortunately, we can't cover all of it, but two in particularly important cultural influences that I wanted to draw out. One is the so-called barbarian invasions that bring Rome and push it off to the brink in the 5th and 6th century. And the other is the rise of Islam in the 7th century, right into Spain and south of France in the 8th century as well. Now, it's unfair to wrap those two together because there's an enormous amount of detail there. But with the first, the barbarians are often seen as a destructive force. And because of what happened afterwards, Islam is seen as an innately foreign force. But again, both of them feed positively into what becomes Europe and the West, don't they?
Right, absolutely. The kind of so-called barbarians, and they are called barbarians by sort of horrified Romans, especially Roman Christians, they are... What's so interesting about them is that by the time that they're coming into the Roman Empire in large numbers, many of them are already Roman citizens, especially the leaders and so on. An awful lot of them are Christian by now, because there's been some very kind of interesting missionary work north of the border. And they often have a more attractive political model to Rome's subjects, which basically is to say that they're less interested in taxing people. It's not quite that they're welcomed in everywhere, certainly not by the Roman army, but unless they're already in the Roman army, which is also true of quite a number of them. It's not a case of a sort of what we would think now, the idea of barbarian, kind of primitive and so on, and a sort of much more advanced society. It's very much a choice that people are making in the kind of border areas between, do we want to stay aligned with the our current sort of overlords and their army and their taxes and so on? Or are we better off trying out these new guys who look like, you know, they might be a bit easier to live with and who are not that unfamiliar in a lot of ways? So I think that's what's going on, one of the things that's going on with barbarians. And then with Islam, of course, I mean, it's so familiar to people. This is, you know, yet another religion coming out of Western Asia, coming into Europe, and coming in the case of Islam in a very sort of, often in a very kind of learned way, that it's the Muslim scientists, who particularly the ones who set up in Spain, in Muslim Spain, Islamic Spain, who really kind of bring science and mathematics and all these kind of things, sort of advanced science, into Europe for the first time, kind of around the 12th century. This is the 12th century Renaissance, people sometimes call it. And basically, these things have more or less disappeared for centuries in Western Europe, along with the loss of the Greek language, basically. People are only using Latin. There's still a lot of education and so on. Again, we're not talking about barbarians here. But people aren't connected. Again, there's a sort of lack of connection in the West in the early medieval period. And so nothing much is happening. Some things are being forgotten. Nothing new is happening. But then these guys, it suddenly turns out that you basically, if you go off to southern France or an Islamic island like Sicily or Malta, or, you know, the absolute kind of keystone is again, Iberia, that you can, and often these are monks and so on who are traveling, and you can meet these incredibly advanced scientists who are bringing not only their own knowledge, not only the knowledge that they famously preserved because they translated a lot of Greek manuscripts, but also the new ideas from India, from Uzbekistan, the kind of actually up-to-the-minute ideas about mathematics, you know, the existence of zero. For instance, invented in India in the 5th century CE, comes into Europe through Islamic science. And that kind of thing, so it becomes a really attractive area and a place of quite extraordinary kind of cultural interchange at the level of scholars. And so I would, you know, there's a rather romantic idea that kind of Islamic Spain was a place of a kind of general multiculturalism and living together happily. And I think that's a bit overplayed for most people. But if you're a sort of traveling academic, basically, you find a very warm welcome in somewhere like Toledo or Granada or somewhere.
I want to begin to draw our strands together before we take some questions from the audience. And I've got a couple of questions in particular, one of which is around this idea of you mentioned the invention of Greece. You might have heard Misha Glenny's had a long-running, really great series on Radio 4 called The Invention Of, which he visits lots of different places and explores how these different identities were developed. And his answer to what was behind the invention of is almost invariably, as you quote Salman Rushdie in your epigraph, a hodgepodge, a bit of this and a bit of that. Not much is original, not much is unique, not much is systematic, and all cultures are dependent on other cultures. But isn't there also something about the way that different cultures are appropriated and adopted by other cultures? Greece may not have invented everything in the way that we once thought it did. But I think, is there not something to be said for the way in which some cultures are more resistant to outside influences and some countries actually, some cultures actually invite them in and integrate them and develop? And perhaps those that do that do deserve more credit for being open and inclusive in that way.
Yeah, I actually think that most human societies probably fit into that category, in fact, that, or at least when you come across ones that don't, there's usually a really clear and specific explanation for it. Whereas I think fundamentally, as humans, we're quite functional, really. We know what's good for us. And so if there isn't a reason, and there can be very, you know, lots of complicated, interesting reasons. But if there isn't a reason not to be curious, outlooking, interested in sort of what we can make of another person, another place, and so on, how that can benefit us in some way, then I think that's why I just think that's kind of the norm, I would say.
Yeah.
So I hope it's not so much a question of giving those societies more credit, but more sort of thinking carefully about societies that aren't like that and trying to think about what went wrong.
Yeah. Yes, it's a very good point. I mean, it's interesting if you look at China 250 or so years ago, China is an incredibly ancient civilization and knows it's very ancient. And it has a great deal of self-confidence. So when it meets ambassadors from Europe in the end of the 18th century, it actually rebuffs them quite peremptorily and said, we've basically got nothing to learn from you. And in the 19th century, that ended up in a catastrophic clash of civilizations. So perhaps some civilizations are more resistant because they're more self-confident.
Well, there's also, I think, in the case of China, and Japan would be another example of this in that period, where, in fact, there's also a kind of lively sensitivity to the dangers that foreigners pose. And of course, I mean, the Chinese certainly learned that they'd been right about that with the introduction of opium by the British to China. So I think there are some people, some cultures, some of the kind of curators of societies can have a sort of reasonable notion of threat, I think. And that would be one of those kind of looking for the specific reason in this case why these people were excluded from that particular place. It's not usually a purely we don't like foreigners. It's usually, and I would say this is also the case with China in that particular example, that we're worried that foreigners pose a danger to our people.
Yeah. Reading Our Times describes itself as a podcast about books, about ideas, about us. And so my last question is always, what does what we've been talking about say about the human condition, about who we are?
So this is interesting. You know, I spend a lot of my time as an academic being very sceptical about the idea of certainly human nature, maybe the human condition more generally. But writing this book made me realise that actually there must be some fundamental shared assumptions that promote communication between humans. And I think I would then actually want to push it kind of further than that and maybe worry a little bit about that concept of human, in the sense that the kind of things that I'm describing in this book, these kind of cultural transmission between very different and distant societies, often through meetings, happens in the animal world as well. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was the famous discovery of the whales in Australia, the humpback whales off the coast of eastern Australia, who... you know, whales have a new song every year and they learn it in their communities and so on. Everyone's known that for a long time. We know that whales teach each other their songs, just in the same way we know that orcas, killer whales, that they teach each other to ram boats these days and so on. But the thing is, orcas are actually quite bigoted animals, and they stay within their own fairly large communities. They're not going to talk to orcas from, you know, the Spanish orcas who are ramming the boats. They're not going to talk to orcas, you know, in the Northern Atlantic or anything. But the humpback whales are not like that. Humpback whales are a very communicative species, apparently. And so they, it turns out, would invent their new song every year, and they'd all learn it, and it all learn it the same way. And things go on for hours, you know. And then every year, a year later, this whole different group of whales in the South Pacific, about 1,000 kilometres away, I think it's in New Caledonia, I'm not absolutely certain, but a long way away, would suddenly start singing exactly the same song as these Australian whales had, Australian in inverted commas whales, had learnt the year before. And they worked out that basically these whales were meeting up on the migration south down to Antarctica and back, also in kind of feeding areas. And basically the Australian whales were teaching the South Pacific whales their song. This goes on for 6 years. And I think, you know, after that, the scientists go stop their study. I think they're probably still up to it. Mm. So I would say it's even bigger than the human condition. I think this is a kind of animal condition.
Yeah, that particularly social animals.
Yeah, social animals, yeah.
The book is called How the World Made the West, a 4,000-year history. Jo Quinn, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times and the Chalk History Festival.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, we have a good 16 minutes for questions. So if you want to put up your hand, wave it vigorously. There should be microphones coming to you.
Thank you. You were just talking about how some societies seem to be more open than others to different ideas and learning from others. Can I ask about ancient Egypt? Because you only mentioned that very briefly. Mm. But I've always understood that their attitude was very much one of, you know, we've got nothing to learn from people outside. We keep ourselves to ourselves. Do you think that's accurate or is it another myth?
Can we take two questions at a time so we can get through as many as possible? So we've got
the memory
test.
And
mine is about the current definition of civilization or civilizations. You said at the beginning that it had changed so much in the 17th to 18th century. In the woke times now, if I was a student with either of you, would that term still be used and what does it mean now?
Great. Over to you.
Okay, so I'll do the last one first because I'll remember it. Especially after writing this book, I can't use it in my teaching. My students would laugh at me. Right? They've all read at least the introduction. So I don't use it. I think I sometimes talk about culture. So one of the things I do say in this book is that certainly you do get that local kind of manifestations, societies, culturally quite distinct sort of phenomena that come and go. And so for quite a while, I talked about cultures, and then my students pointed out to me that that wasn't that different from civilizations, actually, a bit confusing. So now I try and talk about societies. I think that's the kind of fairer, if it's sort of slightly vaguer term. But I do think that you do. It's not that you don't get these kind of conglomerations of ideas coming together, but I think they come out of contact, not sort of in sort of out of their own roots, if you like. Egypt is completely fascinating. So the thing about Egypt, one of the many interesting things about Egypt, so the Nile, it's really a unifying force. So Egypt was one kingdom throughout most of the Bronze Age. Not intermittently, there are kind of complications, of course, but basically it's usually, if you turn up in Egypt in your time machine, good bet it'll be one kingdom. Whereas if you turn up in Mesopotamia or you turn up in Anatolia, or certainly if you turn up in Greece, you'll find loads and loads of little kingdoms most of the time. So Egypt is a kind of that river, and the fact that you can only farm along the river, largely, again, not entirely, but that's the really huge kind of farming opportunity in Egypt, sort of draws it inwards more than outwards. But the river also at the same time is the route to other places. So from very early on, Egypt is very well connected to the south. So what the area the Egyptians called Kush, what we would now call Sudan, part of southern Egypt, and Ethiopia, which was a big ancient kingdom. And also sort of through those areas out to the Arabian Peninsula, also coming down through the Red Sea and so on. All those connections are very, very early. So the Egyptians are connected to other societies from an early period, but more to the east and south in the earth. And then they do become quite connected to the north. One of the things is, certainly before the invention of sailing, it's not that easy to get to places like Mesopotamia from Egypt. Basically, the only way to do it is to get a donkey, which is invented in Eastern Sahara, out of the Nubian wild ass. And you can go on a donkey up sort of through Sinai to the Levant, and then you can go across the mountains and over towards the Euphrates and into Mesopotamia, Babylon, that kind of thing. But we're talking a journey of several months and probably a very grumpy donkey by the end of it. So that there aren't those kinds of connections, except that even though it's really hard to do this, and there's no particular reason to, in a way, it's not that there's anything in Mesopotamia the Egyptians especially need or vice versa. But even so, you get these amazing signs back in the third millennium BCE that actually the Egyptians do know about what's going on in Mesopotamia, as well as places that are much easier to reach from there. So Egyptian hieroglyphics start almost exactly the same time as writing in Mesopotamia. It's totally different kind. I mean, it could not be more different. It's not that the actual technology itself is being transmitted, but the idea, it seems very likely, is. And okay, it might be a coincidence, but then you sort of look at some of the temples in Egypt in that period, some very early temples. And even the way they're doing the brickwork is actually quite similar. So it looks like they're not exactly the same technique, but it produces an effect that's very similar to Mesopotamian temples at that time. So you really get the impression of just a few people making those poor donkeys go, a series of donkeys go on those long, long journeys and coming back and saying, you know what? They write their talk down. What's that about? Let's try that. Or there's this amazing effect you get when the sun hits the temple wall. How can we do that here? So there are. It's a fascinating, in a way, because there's less need for Egypt to be connected to other places. The glimpses you get of connection are all the more interesting. Thanks for the questions.
Right, two more questions. One here, and I'll come to one over there.
Shall I go? Okay,
please.
It's not really a historical question, actually. It's a very modern-day question. You mentioned the lack of connections. Some cultures, civilizations, countries being more resistant to it. I've got my own ideas. I wonder what ideas you had and what present-day countries or whatever are resistant to connections and which ones are embracing them more.
Interesting question. Thank you.
Okay, and great question. Thank you.
Where's the second? Thank you.
You mentioned this was just another religion coming out of the Middle East. Is it a coincidence all the religions came out of there?
Not all of them. There are some world religions.
Yep.
That come out of It's not a coincidence that kind of three of the biggest religions of the modern world, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, all come from really a very small area. And of course, they're very deeply connected to each other and sort of build on each other. So I think that one of the reasons that religion, sort of new religions, especially new monotheistic religions, thrive in the Levant in particular, the Levant and Arabia, is again, it's going to come back, like a broken record here, it's the connections. This is a region that is connected in every direction quite easily connected to other places. So ideas spread, I think, much faster than if you're, on an island somewhere like us or something like that. But it's really, and that would be my best guess as to why, if you want to invent a new religion, I suggest doing it in the Levant. That does seem to work very well. Not the only place, again, but it does seem one of the places that works well. And then the question about the modern day, of course, and this is the other way of approaching the issue of closed civilizations is there's the sort of closed practice where, the traders are literally not allowed to land in the port and are kept on an island outside, or there's that sort of thing where a place is sort of actually practically disconnected. But then I think what's much more important in the modern world with modern communications are the places that are rhetorically disconnected. And so I think here we've got these two civilizational models in the world today, two kind of competing civilizational models. There's one, which is the West and the rest, or the West and the barbarians. And that's kind of, what you hear a lot of at the moment in relation to Israel and Gaza and so on. This is Western civilization. And if there are any other civilizations, we're not really interested, because the important thing is the kind of boundary between civilization that is Western and non-civilization. But then the other model that is actually much more prevalent in the world is the one that we would associate with Putin or Modi or Xi, and the idea of the multipolar kind of international relations model and what are often called world civilizations of Russia, India, China and so on, where there's a very kind of actually very interesting sort of worked out philosophy that a number of world leaders use and discuss quite frequently of this idea of often a fixed number of civilizations, sort of Samuel Huntington style, whether it's sort of 10 or 15 or something, that are equally important and worthy of respect, but very separate from each other, and crucially get to choose who are members of their civilization or not. So this is how, in Modi's India, he can basically treat Muslims as if they're not members of the civilization, this particular Indian world civilization. On the other hand, in Putin's Russia, he can treat Ukrainians as if they are members of the Russian world civilization, whether or not they want to be. So there's a really interesting and kind of terrifying model out there of these very strong but very independent civilizations. And that those two models, I think, are the predominant ones that we're dealing with in the world today.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes. Let's get two more questions. There's a question at the back, and then we'll take a second one maybe at the front. Please.
Thank you. Gosh, what an interesting topic, and I'm looking forward to reading the book very much. 15 years ago, I sat next to the head of the British Council for the Middle East at a dinner, and I asked him why we hadn't seen the Royal Shakespeare Company, the London Symphony, Lloyd Webber, or any of these things. And he said, "Oh, you don't understand. All cultures are equally valid, and our job is to create a space in which those cultures can exchange." And really, nothing happened that very much. I think I know the answer. Did he have a point, or was he off the mark?
Great question. You've got these 4 minutes for that one. And one more here.
There seems to be a theme that each successive society, civilization, culture thinks it's superior to one that came before. Do you think that's part of human nature? Do you think that our slightly critical view of the 17th, 18th, 19th century historians that you began with is part of the same principle in us today, looking down on what's come before? Or is there a Jared Diamond thing? Actually, it's all to do with guns, germs and steel. It's technology that wipes out the people who've come before.
So I think it's not human nature, because among the ancient Greeks, for instance, they have the opposite idea that there was once a golden age, and then there was the silver age, and then there was the age of heroes, and then there was the age of mortals. You know, and it's kind of the opposite of the modern idea of you get the Stone Age and the Iron Age. You kind of think about history in terms of, you know, progress, but you can actually see it the other way around. And that can be equally sort of, you know, psychologically important, sort of culturally important, I think. So that's, I think, would be my counterexample there. So that actually makes it much more interesting, of course, because then you have to think about why did this particular society decide it was, you know, at the top of the rather than the bottom of the decline. You know, this sort of, it's more like a big game of snakes and ladders. People pin themselves in. And the question about the guy, the British Council. I mean, I think the important thing is to give people not just a space to watch each other's cultures, but to really exchange their own experiences and ideas and kind of assumptions even. So that's why I sometimes think the idea that we have to show such respect and demand such respect culturally that we can't allow for sort of mixing and kind of mashups, even misunderstandings. But see, they're the things that actually produce the new. And so I would say, I think he probably is right, but in that particular way, that I think I would have had a bit of Royal Shakespeare company there, I guess.
Thank you very much. So it just remains for me to say that, Joe, I understand you're going to be signing copies of Absolutely. How the World Made the West over in the Waterstones tent straight after this.
Straight after this.
Thank you very much indeed for participating in the Life podcast. If you enjoy intelligent conversation about books, such as we've been provided tonight, please do check the podcast out. There are lots of other great authors there. Thank you all very much for coming, and please join me in thanking Joe for her book and time. Next week, I'll be back in the studio and talking to one of the greatest philosophers of our age, Charles Taylor, about poetry, philosophy, and the spiritual life.
Human societies have always had some kind of connection with the larger order until the rise of modern natural science and the Enlightenment, as it were, killed that or cast that in doubt or made us believe that that was just our own dreaming.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.